Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and welcome to this podcast. In today's segment, we will be interviewing Mr. Alexander Jones, the CEO of one of the top penetration testing firms located out of Washington, D.C. And if I'm correct, Alexander, I think you're located, just one block away from the White House?
Yeah, we're pretty close to the White House over in Washington, D.C. It's a great area to be in. It's great for the exposure to the government side of security, really keeping our ear to the ground of what's going on, what's really going on out there. And so it's a very exciting place.
Awesome. Well, thank you for time, and thank you for joining our show here.
My pleasure.
Okay. Well, first question, we looked up your bio. We do kind of a good background search, not like a background search, but we kind of looked you up on LinkedIn and on Google. And you seem to have a very deep and a very rich background in cybersecurity. And I know that you have a very rich career. And can you just tell us all the highlights of your career? Because I'm very fascinated by it, honestly.
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure. Well, I've worked in cybersecurity now for over 25 years. And I've been doing this all over the world. It's just been quite incredible. I started off in the UK, in London, and I was working close with the intelligence services over there. I worked across Europe and did some very interesting work with the big financials, some of the big banks, but then went across to the Middle East, especially after 9/11. There was a big call for people with a certain set of skills to be over there. And so I spent a lot of years in a lot of the Middle Eastern countries. Then I came over to the U.S., and that was specifically because of Trojan Horse Security. I came over to the U.S. So it's been quite a crazy ride, really. Over my career, I've seen close to 2,000 different companies, various vertical markets, all these different countries. I've worked, on the government side. I've worked on the corporate side. So it's been a whirlwind career with a lot of very interesting experience.
That's exciting. Wow. I wish my career was as varied as deep also in cybersecurity. Now, how did you venture into Trojan Horse Security? Is this a company that you helped to create on your own, or are you the sole owner? Can you please give us more details about that?
Yeah, that'd be my pleasure. Well, as I mentioned, I did come over specifically for Trojan Horse Security. End of 2008, I was still sitting in the Middle East. I was actually in Dubai working in some very interesting contracts over there. And some friends called me up and said that they are starting a new concept of a consulting firm, and would I like to be a part of it? I'd worked with some of these guys before. I knew who they were, they knew who I was, and they asked if I'd like to lead consulting for them. And so, yeah, I came over. It was just such an interesting idea. It was a very refreshing idea. I personally worked with the very best across industry and government for a lot of years, but what they were seeing was that there was a lot of consulting firms who were putting them forward. They brought them in as big names. They were putting them forward and almost like a bait and switch. They're putting in front of clients to do the sale. And really behind that was some junior guys just out of college, guys who had been to Black Hat, done a course there, or they read a hacking book. They got the CEH. They called themselves pen testers, but didn't really have any experience. It was their first gig. And they would do the work. And then they would put these guys, the top hackers' names, on the reports, and they just did not like that at all. And this was happening, it was rife, just completely rife. And they said, and agreed, they didn't want to do that anymore. And so they put together the concept of Trojan Horse Security, a new concept consulting firm. They brought in all the backing. Really strong board. I can't tell you who's on there, but there's crazy names on the board, people you'd have heard of, people who are very high up in government. And so it's really great board guiding us. A lot of money was put into it to secure us, get some good infrastructure, good office, all the equipment we'd need, and set us up and get us out there. So I came over. It was all pretty much set up in terms of the basic infrastructure when I was joining. But I came, joined, and put together my vision of the practice.
Okay, sounds excellent. Now, I understand the implication of the name Trojan Horse Security, but there are other names that, you know, other cybersecurity names that could have, that maybe you thought of in the past. How did you come up with the name Trojan Horse?
Yeah, it was a brainstorm of ideas very, very often in the intelligence work some of us might have been doing. We were almost like a Trojan horse going into certain situations, certain organizations or facilities, and going in that way. And we thought we might be able to bring the concept of the specific set of skills we were bringing into the corporate world. We thought we might be able to leverage a lot of that. And somebody said, hey, why don't we call it Trojan Horse Security? I thought it was just a really great name. And we all liked it, so we said, why not?
Sounds cool. Now, how long has Trojan Horse been in business?
Well, since 2009, beginning of 2009, so about 10 years now. And we're going crazy strong. It's been very popular, very, very popular indeed. We had a very nice, strong launch. Once our guys, key guys in certain consulting firms, once they left, they brought a lot of clients with them. And the word got around. We got a really good reputation going for us, had a lot of media behind us, a lot of exposure. So it's a very strong 10 years. And we're excited now. You know, we just celebrated that. We're excited now for the next 10.
Excellent. Now, do you have a presence in other countries as well? I know you mentioned you've been like literally all over the world, but does Trojan Horse have offices or other pen testers in other parts of the world?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, we're mainly based in the USA. That's where we really do most of our work. We do work globally. So we'll go anywhere in the world. We've got Asia. We do a lot of Europe. Some staff in the Middle East still in some projects in some of those countries out there. But we do have office presence in the UK, in London. We also got a presence in Germany, a very small presence in France. And we can do work from anywhere, you know, whether it's just over the internet or actually going and having a presence. And also some of our analysts, some of our testers, they choose to work internationally. You know, although they are British and Americans, they choose to work internationally, and they focus on very specific things, very specific testing, like web application pen testing and the like. And they say it's internationally, but it's good to have that broad presence all across the globe.
Sounds excellent. Now, who is the typical customer base that you're trying to target? Obviously, any business could use a good pen test. Is the small and medium-sized business, the Fortune 500, or a mixture of both? Or can you please tell us more about that?
Yeah, it'd be my pleasure. So we're not necessarily going out to target a certain company. We want to help all businesses stay secure. And we do work with Fortune 10, the Fortune 500. We do work with many multinational, multi-billion dollar financials. We work with companies that, companies you'll see walking down the street, companies you're likely shopping in. But we also do a lot of work with smaller companies. We've got a whole small business line. We know the importance of keeping secure the general mom part of shops. Accounting firms, law firms, it's really key that they stay secure and keep their clients' data pretty tight. And we also work with a lot of nonprofits. We work with a ton of the nonprofits in DC, even keeping them secure. And that's absolutely critical. Sometimes they just don't have the resources to put in, and we go out, we help them at cost, or even do a write off on that just to make sure that we can go out and help these great organizations.
Oh, it sounds awesome. Well, so you do work like with the smallest of the mom and pops too, then, right? So you're not like, you don't like cherry pick. You will help anybody that needs a pen test, I'm assuming, right?
Absolutely. We don't turn anybody away. Anybody who needs us, we'll be there for them. It doesn't matter the size. And as I say, we've got a small business line. You know, when a small company, they need security, it could be a small accounting firm, for instance, they may need something. We'll come in and we'll do a quick service line for them. It might just be a day. They don't need to come in with $100,000 of services. They just need somebody to come in and just do a day with them, do a quick test of security, help them get some policies and procedures up, some idea of what they should be doing for security, and then leave. And that's good for them. So, we don't turn anybody away. We're there for everybody, whether it's the Fortune 10 who needs a full evaluation of their corporate security going into 100 offices around the globe, or whether it's just one guy sitting in Virginia and he's got a small accounting firm. We're there for everybody.
That's awesome. I love hearing that. Let's get into your product and service line. Could you please elaborate more on the kinds of service offerings you have? I mean, obviously, pen testing is you're trying to break down the walls of defense from the outside in, but there's just so much that's involved. Can you give us some illustrations of the exercise that you do in general without giving away any, like, any secrets or anything?
Yeah, absolutely. We generally have three key areas that we'll work in. As you mentioned, there is the pen testing area, but there's also the defensive area where we'll do some sort of audit and creation of security programs. And then the third area that we'll work in will be the managing of security programs, where we'll manage those over time, and we might act as the virtual CISO or Chief Information Security Officer. So those are the three areas. So we do focus a lot on penetration testing. It could be penetration testing against the networks, the external, the internal. It could be pen testing against web applications, websites, mobile applications, absolutely anything. We also do the physical side, which we've got some crazy reputation around. You know, we bring in guys who are former Delta Force, former CIA. They're just really amazing guys. And a lot of fun to hang out with. And some very big, some of the big tech companies, they want some, so they really want to make sure that physical security is really tight. And you get these guys coming in, they'll find a way in. They will find, you know, whether it's a halo jump onto the roof, you know, down the stairwell, planting a device, whether, and then the pen testers are going to connect to that. Whatever it is, they're going to get in, and it's just so cool working with them. But we do the physical security too, tests around that. So we'll pen test anything. But then when it comes to the audit side, we're doing a lot of the risk assessments, framework assessments, which is a really essential thing for companies to look at for their cybersecurity programs. This could be areas such as ISO, NIST, and the like. It could be framework assessment based around a particular regulation like HIPAA or the NYDFS 500, any of these, GDPR, or even, you know, PCI. So we look at all these frameworks and we do audits around those, or some sort of readiness assessment, getting them ready for that, so don't wait, you know, to the end of the year to try and pass an audit. We'll do a readiness assessment, getting them up to that point. So that's in our second area. In the third area, as I mentioned, which is the running of those security programs. You know, very very often companies, they don't have the resources or the money for a full-time leader in security. They don't have full-time, you know, they don't have the resources for a full-time CISO. And so, you know, and it might not just be resources. It could just be that knowledge. They want somebody to come in like all of us guys, you know, I say, oh, I've got 25 years experience and I've seen 2,000 companies globally. But all of us guys have got that experience now, or at least 10 years of experience at a minimum. And what we do is we bring in that experience to companies and just give them access to all our resources. So we go in and we've got one person who's heading it. We're almost bringing a whole team of resources and experience behind us. And we manage the security program. We'll do a number of services behind that. They'll just buy a huge body of hours. And we'll come in and we'll just revolutionize what they've got. And we'll help their current staff come up to speed, understand security. What we find is there's a lot of professionals out there who just don't, you know, sitting in corporations, they don't understand security. So we'll come in and we'll help them understand that, and we'll really set up more of a secure, mature security program, manage that over time. And as the company grows, we can grow with them and we can step back. We can help put in somebody more full-time if they want, or over the years, we'll just continue managing that for them. And that's really great. So those are our three areas. Kind of we call it attack, defend, and manage.
Okay. Sounds awesome. Now, what key services would you recommend a company to start with? Is it, do you have like a la sweet cart where, you know, the customer can cherry pick, or do you have just like a one-size-fits-all approach, or how do you approach that?
Well, there is going to be, for most companies, like a one-size-fits-all, but for the actual business, you've got to really tailor it down to what they need. If they're just starting out and they're just kind of dipping their toe in the water, they're trying to figure out what they should be doing for security, we recommend two different approaches. The first approach is a pen test, because it's practically going to show them how vulnerable they really are. And we try and deliver what we call the shock and awe. We show them, okay, here's what can happen to your business if you don't get some real maturity in your security program, or if you don't put a security program together to begin with. And we'll go in and we'll hack them from the outside. We'll just walk in, drop devices, walk out, we'll hack them from the inside. We'll totally uncover all of their sensitive information. We'll take over their networks. They won't even see it coming up on any monitoring devices. We'll take them over and just completely and very quickly, usually within 20 minutes, we'll totally take them over, you know, totally take over everything. But then we'll gain access to all their sensitive data. We'll gain access to their email accounts. We gain access to the CEO's information, the CFO's, COO's. That really gets them thinking. And we show how we can exfiltrate that data. We show how they can be put at risk. That shock and awe really shakes them up and makes them realize they have to do something. They're now aware of what they have to do. They have to take steps. There's no question about it. There's no, well, I don't see these hacks going on, or I don't think so. I can bury my head in the sand. Because remember, you know, if you're talking about physical war, you hear the explosions. You hear the bullets going off. You see people dying around you. When it comes to the cyber world, you don't see it. It's just a wire, and you don't see the zero and one flashing across there, the electrical impulses flashing across there, really. But we don't see that the attacks are going on constantly, and it really wakes them up because they actually see the effects. Now, that's the first thing we recommend, the shock and awe. And along with that, second thing we recommend is definitely a framework assessment, and depending upon the company, we'll generally recommend some sort of generic framework, maybe ISO, maybe NIST. It depends upon if the company is under some sort of regulation. We might do a mix of things, and that helps them understand that they're what they have to do for security. It helps them get their hands around the framework. And what we do is we focus on the real key risk areas that they may be facing. And we also score each control under the framework. So just to explain a bit for the listeners who may not understand what these frameworks are, they all have controls, separate little lines that might say, okay, you have to do backups, you have to protect data, you have to install patches. And we see, we risk rate that, we put a score on that, and we say, okay, well, have they got a policy built around that? Are they doing anything in that area? And we put a score, we like to do a score 1 to 4, almost like a GPA, something really easy to understand. We score each control and we roll it up to an overall score. And then they can see, and they come out, say, in the first go, 1.6 or 1.8 out of 4. And the board can understand that. You got some high achievers there who will say, well, I can't have that grade. I need a 3.0 at least. And they start seeing that they can assign resources and money and employees to the IT teams. They see what they have to do in order to follow what we create. We create a roadmap. And so to get themselves up and mature, to get their score up, they start assigning resources. Very often the IT teams are begging for resources. They're begging for help. But this just helps in a real practical way, helps the board see and understand what they need to do in order to protect their company from being breached and causing a lot of issues. So those are the two areas that we recommend. Oh, and just to add to that, actually thinking about it, what we do is we create some slides for the board, so it's really put in a real business way, helping them understand their scoring. And every quarter, when they have a quarterly board meeting, we'll do an update. We'll do an update on the framework assessment, and we'll update that score. And so over time, that board can see the return on investment. And they see the score, say, go from 1.6 to 1.7, 1.8. They start getting in the twos. And over a year or two, depending upon how many resources they throw at it and the real state they start from, they see the score improve and the cybersecurity maturity improve. That's really, really great for them. So those two services, the shock and awe, the practical implication of the breach, and then the framework assessment with the scoring and maturity models, those two together really help start any company in the right direction.
Sounds awesome. Wow. Now, obviously, you must have some exciting client story engagements. Can you please share some with us?
Yeah, I'd love to. We've actually got some of these printed in the media. One came out many years ago in the Daily Mail, which is the largest online newspaper in the world. They printed some really cool stories about us. And one that's particularly interesting was this is going back many years, but it's a bit of fun. I was on an engagement and I needed to do a basic internal test, which started with a physical assessment. It was going to end up me sitting in the company and just hacking away, and then later on gaining access to some physical information. So when we do these physical assessments, it really is all about psychology. I put on a three-piece suit, pinstripe, stand up tall, as I was trained, and go in with a lot of confidence. And so around lunchtime, I follow people back in through the security doors. I go in with a fake badge. I know exactly what the badge is going to look like because I stake the place out beforehand. We've got badge makers. And I make my way in, a lot of confidence, past the security desk. Nobody even wants to talk with me. Now, sometimes I'll be on the phone and just talking away. And then, of course, people want to be polite. They don't want to interrupt somebody. But especially, they don't want to interrupt an executive or who they perceive to be an executive. So I go into this office very, very, very confidently and go ahead. I take a staircase and I look around for somewhere to plug in. I couldn't find anywhere. So I found my way across to an executive area. And there was an office there. Very nice office, beautiful coffee maker. I thought, I'm going to make myself at home here because the light was off. It appears that that person was in today. So I went in, shut the door, made some coffee, got my laptop open, plugged in, started hacking. Well, next thing I know, there's a knock on the door. Somebody comes in and said, oh, I was looking for Gene. So I said, oh, Gene's not here today. Now I know whose office it is. So they closed the door, not a problem. Well, 10 minutes later, another knock on the door. Someone comes in, I pop my head up and say, oh, Gene's not here today. Oh, I'm Gene, says the lady. I said, oh, I was told you weren't here today. Please take your desk, take your office back. Oh, no, sir, she says. Oh, no. Please, you take my office. No, you mean, please. This went back and forth. You take it. No, you take it. In the end, she decided she's going to go and find somewhere else to sit. She thought I was from a head office that had a head office in New York. They thought I was from New York head office, and I must be very high up. And she goes off. So I sit there. I hack. I take all that data, totally own the whole network. And I'm sitting there till about 7 o'clock. I want everybody to go home. I come up the office. A lot of the lights are off. I walk around the office, lifting up the keyboards, looking for the passwords, opening drawers, looking for the checkbooks and the credit cards, you know, the company ones, not people's personal ones, of course. And then I look for, you know, opening up files, financial information, taking photos of people's financial, all the financial records of the company, walking into other executive offices, and then on my way. It's a crazy story, but it really, there's a few more. If the listeners want to, just Google Alexander Jones, Trojan Horse Security, Daily Mail. The first link will come up with a few other interesting, funny stories, very entertaining stories. And it's unbelievable how vulnerable companies are in terms of physical security, how trusting employees are, even when they're very well trained. I've been in places where they're very well trained, there's heavy consequences against them. They're still incredibly vulnerable as compared to certain places in the Middle East or other places. The companies aren't really focusing on physical security like they should do. So it's very, very difficult. But that's a interesting and entertaining story from the field.
Wow, that's exciting. Do you have any more exciting stories? We got time.
Okay. Give me one moment, and I will give you another exciting story. I want to do this one. Be careful which stories I tell, so hold on 2 seconds.
Kind of like James Bond in a way.
Oh, yes. This is a very, very interesting one. This one was very, very interesting because it was in a medical facility. That was fascinating, in fact. There was a very high security medical facility that I wanted to get into. I went over to it, and I knew it wasn't going to be easy because I looked at the floor plans online. They had them online. I saw it was very well guarded. So I walked in very well prepared. I went up to the security desk and gave over a business card, again, tending to be from a head office. And this head office was a London-based head office. I'd looked up who the board was. I thought, okay, I kind of look like this person. Let me go on as them. So I printed up business cards and badges and everything as if I was just over from that head office. They're close to that manufacturing facility. There was another office, the actual corporate offices, and I decided to go in with the ruse that I'd been sent over from those offices. They'd said, if you want a tour, you've got to come over and you've got to speak to, I looked up the chap's name, who was the general manager in this plant. They said, you've got to speak to whoever it was, and he'll give you a tour. So I walk in there, three-piece suit, a lot of confidence, went up to the front desk, threw up my card, said, I am person, you know, whoever it was, whatever my name was supposed to be at the time, Alexander Smith, and I want to speak to whoever the general manager was, and I'm told I can get a tour. I'm just come across from the other offices across town. And they said, no problem. Well, sir, let me call him over. So I was waiting 2 minutes, and he comes running out. I hear you want a tour. Well, yes, I do. So he's taking me around the whole facility. Now, this is a very high, supposedly high secure facility. In each area, they had to wear different coats. So you'd wear a white coat in one area, a lab coat type of thing. You'd wear a blue coat in another area, green, red. And you couldn't be in another area. So if you're wearing the white coat, you couldn't be in the red coat area. That was a complete no-no. You also shouldn't bring in cell phones, recording equipment, any of this sort of thing. But of course, I'm going in there with my buttonhole camera and all this sort of stuff, you know, taking pictures and the like, and coming in with equipment, technical equipment that wasn't looked at. So he's given me the whole tour, taking me through area after area, and I'm snapping pictures and video and the whole lot going on. And then takes me into the server room. He said, do you want to see anything else? I'd like to see, you know, technical equipment, you know, have a look at that. Let's see what all runs. So he takes me in that area. He's introducing me to people. And while we're in the server area, I happened to drop a device on the network. They weren't looking. They were chatting about something going on. I slipped something on their network, and the light on it goes green. Great connection. And then we finish up the tour, and I go. Well, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing. A very high secure facility, very hard to get into. They supposedly have all the security, but they didn't even check who I was. They just believed it based on the confidence I came in with and who I was representing myself as. Not very good in reality, but that's why they do the testing. The device I dropped in, unfortunately for them, did give me my team a connection into their network, and I had people on the outside. And with that connection in, what it does, it makes a connection out of the network to our command and control server. So we've got basically a connection into the network. And so they could then do this, do the hacking of the internal and start showing how they could then take the trade secrets, company secrets out of this so-called high security network. So very interesting, very interesting. There were some great lessons learned there for that company. And now anybody who walks into that facility, I bet, really gets grills. They're not trusting anybody.
Wow, that sounds fascinating. Now, do you have any customer success stories that you'd like to share with us?
Customer success stories, was that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay, no, absolutely. You know, there's one particular one I'd love to share, because it really highlights what we're all about. You know, besides the quality, I think everybody who knows Trojan Horse Security, they know the quality, that we're all about quality and real high skill. But one of the best success stories that I love, because of the highlight, how it really highlights some of our other areas, other pillars that we really believe in terms of the service, is the following. We were called, I think it's about 5 years ago now, we were called by a company. It's a very big, well-known multinational company, and they had, they used to be doing their own PCI penetration testing, and they were reasonable at it, you know, they were doing a reasonable job, but they did have, of course, somebody coming in and doing the PCI audit, QSA, coming along and doing the audit, signing them off, and it was one of these big brand name consulting firms. And 1 week before they had to be certified, they dropped on them that they weren't going to accept their internal pen tests. They were only going to accept a third party doing it, and they could do it for this exorbitant amount of money. They thought they had them by the... they were in a panic about it. They did not want to be really exploited in this way. They didn't want to have to pay this exorbitant fee. And they decided, okay, you dropped it on us on Monday. You've told us this. We've got till Friday. Let's see what we can do. So they happened to give us a call on the Monday. We said, no problem. We got them the statement of work to do what they needed to do as the PCI pen test. We got that. We guarantee it within 24 hours. There's no sitting around waiting 3 weeks for a statement of work with us. We got them that statement of work very quickly, in a couple of hours. And that was signed off on Tuesday. It took 24 hours to sign, which really limited the time that we had. But so we're like, no problem. We got there on the Wednesday. So the team, I had two teams on it. I had an external team who were testing the internet-facing systems that would be in scope for PCI. And a number of guys, and there was thousands of IPs, but I put a whole team on that. I took a team on site, and we did the internal testing, great results, and we all put something together. We had people doing the reporting, and by 6 p.m. Friday night, we had the whole PCI assessment done for this huge multinational, multi-billion dollar tech company. We had it all done within 3 days. Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and they've been a strong customer ever since, one of our best, and we've got such a strong relationship with these people. But that highlights, you know, great customer success story. the competing vendor, the competing consulting firm who tried to get away with this exorbitant fee for pen testing, they were really upset at us. They knew who we were from the beginning, because very often we're outbidding for work from many other companies, and they go, oh, Trojan horse again, of course we lost that. So they know who we were. They knew they lost it. They were upset, but what can they do? That's justice for you. And we are really glad that we got to go in and help them. And we, you know, companies, you know, do say to us now, you know, they say to us, well, you know, how quickly could you get started? How quickly could you finish? So, well, we've got 24/7 teams running around the clock, 365. We've got an international presence. We can get things done for you. And we highlight this story. We tell people this story. And we've got tons of stories just like this. If people need things done, we'll make it happen. We don't care. We'll make it happen. We're all about making sure that our clients' goals are hit with incredibly high quality, but incredibly high service. And of course, you know, making sure the value's there. We don't need to take anybody for a ride. We believe in just a fair fee, flat rate for everybody, and then just doing the right thing. We believe that way we develop great relationships with companies for many years. We're about the long-term relationship, right? It's not just a cliche for us. We like to really develop what we call friendships with companies.
Sure.
And we know that, you know, we do that when honest relationship, not just, you know, just pretending, you know, just to try and make friends, but real honest friendships with people in these companies who they got a job, we got a job, we get on really great. We do whatever we can to help them out. And we develop these relationships for years with these people. When they go from company to company, they stay with us. They call us up. They say, hey, Alexander, I'm with this new company now. Can you come in here? No problem, mate. No problem. So anyway,
yeah,
to cut things short, you know, to make sure I think that's a great customer success story.
Oh, it sounds awesome. Now, obviously, there are a ton of investing companies, you know, here in the United States, the Bay Area, East Coast, and Texas. What separates Trojan Horse Security from the other vendors? In other words, why should customer XYZ say, hey, Alexander, I want to come to you first versus all these other pen testers?
Well, most times people have heard of us, and they know from their friends or from some other source, professional source, then they know who we are. And they know we stand for three things, quality, value, and service. You know, and really, those three set us apart. People say to us sometimes on calls, well, who's your competition? And we say, there is no competition. And we don't mean that in a cocky way. We just know that there aren't other consulting firms out there that are bringing that consistent quality. As you mentioned in the beginning of this podcast interview, we mentioned that we were established originally because there's a lot of these key people out there that were just fed up with being the bait and switch, being the one or two quality people in those big, well-known brand name consulting firms, having their name put on a report, but they were never doing the testing. And you know, what's really separates us is that everybody's high quality. We don't bring anybody out, you know, out of college. There's no real people, you know, have got less than 10 years experience. Most people have got about 20 years experience. They're really hardcore. The quality is consistently there. Couple that with the service, we're obsessed with service. We're just obsessed with it. Whatever we can do, we're not sticklers for a statement of work and the scope and all that. Whatever we can do, we take care of the clients. We just take care of them. It's not about a service, you know, name. It's not about, oh, we're coming to do a pen test. We're coming to make them secure. We're coming to help them make their lives easier. We're coming to do a great service. So we're there to make them secure, and we're all about service, whatever it takes. We get them a statement of work within a couple of hours usually. We guarantee it within 24 hours, not 2 weeks later, 24 hours, which is free. So, you know, really, we're on the ball. We're fast. We're moving. We're there for them. So the service is great and the value. We hear again and again people just talking back to us, you know, quality, value, and service. Again and again, the value is a fair price. You know, we're not going to suddenly send statements of work out for crazy prices. It's just, you know, whatever it happens to be. If it takes us a week, it's a week of consulting time. That's it. We're not going to charge them 5 weeks for a week of work. It's just the real value for the quality and service that we're bringing. And those three pillars really set us apart. So there is no real competition with it. It's just, and we do nine times out of 10 companies are going with us. They're choosing us. You know, they'll get three bids. Nine times out of 10, they'll come with Trojan Horse Security because they feel that, you know, feel really confident to, you know, to stipulate that they want us over any other firm because they really feel confident that they're going to get what they need to fulfill their project and be secure. You know, so quality, value, and service.
That sounds awesome. Now, on other, now to change to a more macro level, global level, on other points, you know, we keep hearing about the nation state threat actors like North Korea, China, Russia. You know, I don't mean to get political in this question, but, you know, we've heard about the Russian meddling in the elections and, you know, the Mueller report. What are your thoughts on that? Just on the top of your head, like what do you think of?
Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting. Being in D.C., we really hear what's truly going on. And if you knew what was going on, it would scare the whatever out of you. You know, it's crazy what's truly going on. I think, you know, although we hear those sort of things a lot, I think people should have confidence that the United States is doing an incredible job in the cyber war. They have fantastic people and the resources, and you know, that's really, you know, in the digital warfare teams that we're seeing that there are obviously weaknesses. We've had some very serious breaches from certain you know, bad players, the Russians, the Chinese, North Koreans, the Iranians. We've had some really bad breaches, like the OPM hack. That was terrible. And they never really said really how bad it was. But that was awful. That was one of the worst. And we've had some bad hacks, you know, into the United States. But on a positive note, we've hacked them back 10 times worse. So, you know, when it comes down to it, we're still doing well. I think a great example of that was when the Iranians shot down the drone. President Trump didn't launch, you know, and kill 150 people. He, one of his responses was to hack into the facilities that did launch the rockets and shut them down. Absolutely brilliant. And he said, look, you know, you think you can do things. We're inside you too. And we've got a serious presence all around the globe, and it's pretty amazing. The cities, when it comes down to the cities, they're in a really bad state, as we saw with Baltimore, absolutely terrible state, and they've got to really, really worry. They're getting hit by ransomware like crazy, they're getting hit by these bad actors in a terrible, terrible way. Corporations, I think it's interesting with corporations. Corporations do need to worry about these, specifically those who they manufacture something or they've got some sort of trade secret. They have to really, really be concerned. And the biggest threat is China. They're causing a lot of problems. And they've done it for years. And unfortunately, in some ways, but not all, people think it's been totally ignored, but it hasn't. But in some ways, it has been ignored. And companies who haven't taken their security seriously, this is both technical security and physical security, companies who haven't taken their security seriously, they have found that their product has been made in China for a lot less, shipped over here, sold for a lot less, shipped around the world sometimes, and made around the world for a lot less. And then what they find is that they suddenly are out of business. And then we'll ask themselves why. So companies really, really need to take their security seriously. This has to come from the top. It has to come from the board. And they have to recognize that if they don't take this seriously as a business decision, they will be out of business. The espionage is, on that level is crazy. They are literally happy to walk into a building or try and get into a building, plant a device, and then, you know, hack from there. They're happy to pay people serious money just to put a USB drive in a machine. And if we found people are taking it. We've had engagements where we've been asked to test employees just to see what could we see if we could get people to put devices in machines or devices on networks to see what would their response be. Also, we find that, you know, we might drop USB drives in the car parks or outside a corporate office, see if those USB drives are taken and installed. So there's a lot that has to be done, physical security and technical security. It's a real concern. Again, it's China. China's one of the biggest threats to corporations in the United States when they've got something like a trade secret or the like.
Gotcha. Now, how do you foresee the cyber threat landscape changing, evolving in the coming years? And from that, what do you think the biggest cyber threat will be here?
Now, that's a really good question. You know, it's always hard to predict the future. But if we go back a little bit and look at this historically, what we saw in the early days of computing, it used to be that security wasn't understood, but we used to see that you could literally, you know, I can tell you this as a professional hacker, you could literally sit anywhere on the internet and you could hack into most companies. I'm talking even the biggest banks. You know, say in 2000, you could literally sit and from your home, you could hack into most any of the major banks in the world through their, you know, internet-facing servers. Just so easy. It was just a walk in the park. Then they kind of figured out that they need to secure those. They need to set strong passwords. They need to harden. They need to make sure the patches are installed. And so what we saw was by about 2005, 2006, companies had really strong exteriors, really strong internet-facing presence. Not perfect, but, you know, pretty good. And so the way we used to try and hack in was through phishing emails. And that's the way the hackers went. That's the way we went. And that was the way in. And then that led to a lot of successful breaches. A few years ago, what we saw then evolved, people said, well, how can we monetize this better? Because remember, it's all about monetization at the end of the day. Stealing data, stealing corporate secrets, stealing credit card numbers. It's all about monetization. And trying to sell these credit card numbers, say, and social security numbers, there's a certain value to it, but sometimes, well, the value started going down a little bit, and it wasn't as easy to use the credit card numbers as it was previously. So people started saying, well, what can we do? Well, ransomware came out, and ransomware, people weren't prepared for it. People still aren't prepared for it. People don't understand it. People don't understand phishing. People don't understand how to protect themselves from these things. It's quite shocking, but it's so easy to inoculate oneself from these attacks. So ransomware is a big threat, and as I'd predicted in a different interview, well, I don't know, a year, year and a half ago, what we're seeing is ransomware 2.0 come out. And this is where there's almost like a layer on top of it where there's a command and control. So that machine's taken over, but then from that machine, they can take over other systems in the network. Well, the way it used to spread was because it got onto one machine, it could spread because other machines were vulnerable to a particular exploit, such as the WannaCry type of ransomware. You know, it was spreading through Eternal Blue, the MS-17010 vulnerability. It might spread to other machines that are vulnerable to that. It could also spread in an automated fashion because it might dump the SAM file. And if you've got, say, a local administrator account on that one machine, and it's the same local administrator password on all other machines, it could just spread out from that one machine and take over everything really, really quickly. And there's been different variations, dumping of other sort of tokens and hashes to spread out. Well, a 2.0 sort of scenario would be where it does try these things, but then there's also a manual element where it calls back home and somebody takes over and they start hacking and they start trying to get into other systems, trying to look for that sensitive data or trying to encrypt those systems as well. So they've actually got their hands the data. One of the advantages of ransomware, it used to be, if you could call it an advantage, was that somebody at least wasn't in your network. You would say, well, at least they're not in my network. Okay, my whole workstation land is taken over, but that may be where it stopped. And then I can just blow that away, really image, and the data secure, or that, you know, at least the hacker didn't have access to those secrets. Well, now it's kind of evolving. And I see this really taking off, really, because it just works. I really see ransomware 2.0 really just spreading out. I see a lot more phishing. It's all going to be continually, until companies really get it together, it's going to be about phishing. It's going to be about ransomware more and more.
Hello?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Okay, yeah, we're having some thunderstorms here, so the power's been kind of going on and off here, so we're okay, though.
Okay. Marvelous. Okay, so that's what I, yeah, that's what I see. I see, you know, a lot more ransomware coming out, and it really evolving, you know, into like a 2.0 sort of scenario.
Okay, sounds excellent. Now, what do you recommend for people to do to protect themselves from their environment, you know, from cyber hacks, cyber attacks? I mean, I keep getting asked this question all the time. You know, I keep asking my guests, what can they do to protect themselves?
Yeah, so I know we wanted to talk about a couple of specific areas. Let's talk about a couple of, let's talk in general and maybe then go to specifics from there. I think that'd be really good. So one thing myself and my colleagues, my group, we all talk about is the need to focus on the basics. We see a lot of companies out there that really miss the basics, but they buy these multi-million-dollar software packages and setups, these fantastic state-of-the-art SIMs, which they never seem to set up correctly. But, you know, they'll get the top firewalls, they'll get the top everything, and then they'll leave passwords, basic passwords not set, or the default passwords, or they'll miss patches. A lack of hardening, and I can tell you, doesn't matter how great your SIM is, it's not going to detect what we're doing. And if you have a system that's using a default password, well, that's just a login. It's never going to get picked up on a SIM because that's a legitimate network traffic, right? Somebody logging in. Great. Well, that's not going to flag anything. So companies need to focus on the basics. They need to focus on the patching. They need to focus on the hardening of systems and networks. They need to focus on really strong passwords. That's really essential. They need to focus on segmentation. That's a really big thing. They need to segment their critical data away from their main LANs. There should be no reason why somebody in marketing should be able to access the main database or database farm. That's really important. But also segmentation of credentials. That's really, really key. You don't want somebody with admin credentials, even if they've got two levels of credentials, you don't want them to be logging into a PC, for instance, with a credential, admin credential, that could access, say, the main database. Because if someone gets access to that on that PC level, that basic level, they could dump that cache credential potentially from that machine, or dump the token, and then they could use that to spread all across the network and get access to everything. So there needs to be really strong segmentation. And when we're talking about segmentation of credentials, you don't even want to have sometimes, you don't even want to be in the same forest. You don't even want to be in the same Active Directory network. Domain. You know, if you've got, say, your credit card network, you know, in the stores, that should really be in a separate, completely separate forest Active Directory domain from the corporate network, because you want it completely segmented in that way. So that's a big one. Another big thing is egress filtering, the outbound traffic. Very often, companies could have reasonable inbound or ingress filtering, but outbound filtering is atrocious. And this is really meaningful when it comes down to phishing, which I'll talk about in a minute. But you know, it's really makes a big impact on phishing. It makes a big impact on data loss prevention strategies around that. So the basics, companies have to really focus on the basics. They have to either themselves, they have to understand basic security fundamentals, or they have to bring in a really good partner who does understand and help guide them how they should set things up in order to protect themselves from breaches, or if somebody does get access to something that could be detected and the hacker couldn't get anywhere else. Let's talk about phishing. Let's talk about phishing, which is a big attack. Pardon?
Yeah, that was the next question I was going to ask you, actually, was about phishing.
fantastic. Yeah, because this really gets a lot of companies. They really don't understand, and people need to do what's called inoculate themselves from these attacks, and they need to inoculate themselves from phishing. So it needs to be understood in stages of what's happening and what the purpose also, what's the purpose of what they're trying to do when it comes down to phishing. So there's actually two things they're trying to do when it comes down to phishing. An attacker is either trying to get hold of a credential they could use to gain access to another system or get access to a VPN, get access to the network, or they're trying to get a back channel out of the network. So if somebody does execute something on the machine, they're trying to get a channel from that machine to their command and control server, and then they've got access to the internal network. So those are the two things that are trying to be done. So in stages, the first thing they're going to do is they're going to send an email in. Well, if we can set up really good spam filtering, then it can stop a lot of these emails coming in. And literally, you could see companies can see thousands of emails, sometimes tens of thousands of emails coming in every day, and they should be blocked. You want to make sure you block as many as possible. So you need a really good spam filter, but it needs to be set up correctly. It needs to be set up correctly in the first place. Companies should make sure that they set things up. They need to make sure if they've got a particular domain that emails should be coming from, anything that's similar to it should be blocked. So if the domain was, for instance, google.com, for instance, what we do is take that domain. If something comes from Google but the O's are zeros, we would make sure that gets blocked. That's automatically seen as spam. So we just put that in the drop. Then, you know, what about if it's google.co, google.org? That would get dropped. So they need to make sure they're really setting up these spam filters really, really well so the emails don't come in. Then they need to make sure, okay, what's the next thing? And then it hits the user. Well, we need to do what's called inoculate the user. We need to take the power out of the user's hands. What we need to do is we need to make sure that we are setting up multi-factor authentication, so that if the user does give away their password, they don't have the next form of authentication that have the token. And I really like the biometrics because that's harder to phish. So they can't, you know, it's easier to phish a token than it is somebody's fingerprint. So it's not perfect, but setting up multi-factor authentication can really help. So if they do give away the password, not such a big deal. And this then should, of course, be multi-factor authentication for all the systems that are internet-facing. But then what if they... if they receive... So go on.
No, go ahead.
Oh, okay. So I was just going to say that then the other thing that the attackers are going to try and do is execute something on the machine. Well, we should, the user, the employee, should not have any rights to execute anything on that machine. It's really essential to take that power away from the user. So we need to take off from that local admin rights, install rights, take off PowerShell if we can from that local system, take away everything, take off the local admin credential, make sure admins haven't logged into that machine, make sure there's no sensitive data or any data stored on that machine at all. So then what happens is that, okay, if they did manage to get something through and executes anyway, what we need to make sure then is say, okay, they executed something. It's going to try and make a connection out of the network. We should have a really strong outbound filtering on that network so that if something does try and get out, it blocks it and it sends the alert to the security administrators to isolate that machine from the network and let them know that something's happened, a security event has happened or potentially happened, because they should not have direct access to the internet at all, at all. The only access that should have is over port 80 and 443, and that should be going through a proxy server, very, very well thought at breaking connections and reestablishing them if seen secure. So that's really, really essential. So then they're inoculated from phishing. They can't use the passwords. They can't get a connection outbound. And then what we're doing effectively is taking the power out of the hands of the user, of the employee. People often say that it's the employees the weakest link. Well, what employees? It's a great bromide. People keep repeating this, but the reality is it's not the employees that are the weakest link. And if they are, then we've given them too much power. It's the IT employees who are the weakest link because they're giving their employees too much power and responsibility. And we can train them as much as we want. And, yeah, we should train them in security awareness, but we shouldn't give them the responsibility to protect the company. That's in the IT teams, security teams. And we need to make sure that we take the power away from them and everything's perfectly or properly secured. So before I move on to ransomware, talking about what we can do there, I know you were about to ask a question, so let me give you a moment for that.
Yeah, actually, biometrics has been my area of specialization for quite a long time. So what you talk about multi-factor authentication, we've seen that being popularly used, like on the iPhone, the Face ID, Touch ID. Have you done any work in biometrics, and what is your favorite favorite biometric modality that you'd recommend?
Well, from a basic setup, I like anything. Anything biometric, the fingerprint or the Face ID. I don't like the tokens so much because they can easily be phished. Now, there's always ways around. When these first biometrics first came out, there were some interesting ways around those systems. But, the token, the code that gets sent to the phone or that is on the phone that keeps changing, that can be phished. So if an attacker sets up a phishing site, they can set it up to look exactly like the corporate email system or the VPN, and they ask for the username, the password, and the token. People think, oh, well, it's asking for a token. It looks very secure. They look at the site, and they put in there all those three credentials, and it can automatically be replayed to gain access to the real system. We actually did this on a large insurance company a couple of years back. It was one of our best calls ever. We gained access to, I think, something like 30 million records or something. It was quite crazy. That was because we took the username, we took the password, we took the token. However, if it was that it wasn't asking for a token, they didn't get the opportunity to ask for a token. They had to have something sent to their phone. For biometrics, it's a lot harder to hack. It is possible still to get around that. It is absolutely possible because what it does is it turns around with the username and the password. It sends it to the real system. It okays it, and it still sends the thing to the person's phone. But it's about security in depth. We've got to do the best we can and try and inoculate as much as possible. But I'm happy with any biometric system as the first step forward.
Sounds awesome. Yeah, my favorites are actually, I think, the iris recognition. In fact, I
believe cool.
straight out of the UK at the, I think, University of Cambridge, Dr. John Dogman. I'm not sure if you've heard the name or not. He is the actual inventor of the iris recognition algorithms, and he is one genius. In fact, I've written a book. My third book is on the science of biometrics, where I've actually got into all the mathematical and statistical algorithms that are used in both iris and facial recognition. I mean, it's deep stuff. He uses a concept called Gabor wavelet mathematics, and what they do is they extract the unique features, spatial vector orientations of the unique features from the iris, and they kind of put them in Cartesian geometric planes. It's kind of above my head, but maybe that might be a talk for a different podcast. But anyway, let's go into ransomware. I think that's something you want to talk about. And as we know, that's one of the hot, that's probably the biggest threat today. In fact, I just wrote a blog posting. And it's like Baltimore, I think Baltimore, Maryland, they were hit with a ransomware attack, and they ended up having to pay the ransom. So who's to say that the same cyber attacker won't come back and attack something much larger, you know, like critical infrastructure, you know, like traffic lights, water supply, you know, gas pipeline systems. So should we be paying these cyber attackers that do ransomware? Because my belief is no, we should not pay them. They're just gonna keep coming back for more and more.
Yeah, that's always a tricky one. And some people say definitely don't pay it because of that. You don't even know if they're going to unlock the systems anyway. And maybe they just come back for more and more later. It does encourage. It's interesting how it's run. It's run like almost like a business. They want to have like almost like that 5-star Amazon rating in that they want to be known as having a good reputation for actually unlocking and giving back companies access to their data. They have help desks helping people access Bitcoin, buying Bitcoin, and walking them through how to do everything. It's pretty crazy. Very often, yeah, that'll unlock, but it is encouraging. What companies really need to do is inoculate themselves from ransomware so that it either stops it, or if they do get hit by it, it's minimized and they can recover very quickly. And this really needs to be a part of their BCDR plans, their business continuity disaster recovery plans. They need to practice and really make sure that they know exactly what to do if they do get hit. The first thing, again, is make sure it doesn't come in. Don't put the power in the hands of the user to try and decide what's, you know, if it's a real email or not. Make sure it doesn't come in. Make sure those spam filters are really well set. Make sure people can't bring it in any other ways. Turn off USB drives, for instance. Take the power out of the hands of the employees. But if it does hit, they need to be prepared. First of all, we want to make sure that we've got a really good air-gapped backup strategy so that your backups can't get hit along with everything else. Things should be segmented. The backup should be well away from everything. And the next thing is if it does get hit, one machine gets hit, well, the companies need to understand how much it's going to propagate from there. Well, companies need to, actually stepping back a bit, companies need to make sure they've got really good cyber hygiene. So don't give these guys local admin rights. Don't give them install rights. Take the power away. Take off PowerShell from these machines if they can so that they can't install the ransomware in the first place and it can't encrypt anything. If it does encrypt something, okay, how's it going to get around? It's going to try and get around by one of these unpatched machines. So they need to start patching things. And it's amazing. I still see the MS-17010 vulnerability inside corporations. It's amazing. It's always one machine, and it's such an amazing exploit. It's so easy to exploit and get a shell on systems and propagate around from there. So they need to patch everything, and then they need to make sure that they can't propagate, can't laterally move around the network, so get rid of that local admin, make sure there's no cached admin credentials on those machines, and they can't move around. Make sure they've got really good segmentation in the network that can be cut off really quickly. We've got a client, a manufacturing client, and very interestingly, one of their plants did get hit by ransomware, and they just cut all the systems off from the main network very quickly, and then they re-imaged all the machines in there and put the data back on, and it took them a couple of hours, and they were back up and running. So it didn't even affect them. So really great segmentation is important, and we've mentioned the backups. They've got to have a strategy. They know exactly what to do. So, okay, they get hit by ransomware. They try and stop it. They try and make sure it doesn't propagate. If it does, cut it off, re-image, back to work. But most companies haven't got that set up. They haven't got it to the strategy. They don't know what to do. They don't have any procedures around this. They haven't got the training. They haven't done a tabletop exercise around it. They haven't planned for it. So, like with bulletin boards, you say when they get hit by it for a second time, you know, the 911 systems got hit, now the main areas got hit. A year later, they just don't know what to do, and it spreads around these antiquated infrastructures. It's interesting, you know, you mentioned the oil pipelines or the energy systems or any of these critical infrastructures. These systems shouldn't have any internet access, or the main areas, you know, the key areas. Say it's a power company. The grid should not be on the internet. There's no question about it. It should be completely air-gapped. You might have a customer service department. You might have other departments that may need some internet access. Great. Let them send emails, give them some sort of internet access. That's great. But that should be completely air-gapped from everything else. Traffic lights, why would a traffic light be on the internet? Why would it even be connected to a network that is? And when people say, oh, it's segmented. No, you know, you've got to – you may have it segmented because it's in a different subnet. That doesn't mean it's truly segmented. That's just in a different subnet. Or they may have a member firewall between it or a jump box, you know. I mean, no, they need to be on completely different networks when it's that critical. They need to assess the risk and remove the risk. They really inoculate themselves with that. That's just basics. Absolute basics. Too many times we've seen the jump boxes and the like. We've just completely gone through those, walked through those, and because of improper security set up. So that's my recommendation on ransomware: inoculate and then make it so you've got all the plans in place. Where if you get hit, so what? We can be back up and running within no time.
Okay. Now, as we wrap up our show here, I'm going to combine two questions into one. We have all, or probably a good portion of, you know, the American population has heard of the Internet of Things, IoT, you know, where everything's all connected, you know, smart homes, smart cities. I don't know. To me, it seems very scary to have everything connected because it's just more attack surface for the cyber attacker. What are your thoughts on that? And finally, what's the last thought you'd like to leave to our listeners in general?
Okay, when it comes down to the IoT, you know, if it's at home, would somebody care if their fridge was hacked into? Well, only if it turns off and sells the milk and your frozen vegetables, frozen meat gets thawed out. But, you know, the big thing with these devices is that people need to be aware. They need to be aware, and most people just won't have the ability to know what to do, but they should be aware of what they're putting on the home network. And very often these are set with default passwords from the home router to the security camera and the like. Some might have an outbound connection to some third-party service provider. Some might be, you know, sitting right on the internet. And if these are inside of a third party, if these are calling back to a third party service provider, that third party service provider gets hacked, then you've got to ask yourself, well, how's that going to affect me? They're going to gain access to your home network. In companies, it's an interesting situation. People are putting these Chinese cameras, video cameras, on the network, and they may call back to a third party service. Or they may actually just call back to Chinese intelligence, giving them access to the corporate networks. It's not a good situation. IoT can be really a serious vulnerability for a lot of companies and a lot of people as individuals, and they need to really assess what they're putting on their networks, home or corporate. The last interesting thing to say about these IoT devices is that they easily get taken over and can be used as part of major scale botnets, which is always interesting what these can be used for. Now you asked, what would I like to what would I like to leave the listeners with as the last thought and comment?
Yeah, what's your parting thought?
My parting thought, companies need to take security seriously, and we still see they're not. Need to focus on the basics. They really need to focus on the basics over everything. Patching, passwords of all systems. They need to focus on really good hardening of networks, filtering, the egress filtering is very important, the segmentation, really focusing on these basic things. We spoke about a number of different areas on this podcast, and one of the areas we did mention was the phishing and the ransomware. I want to just restate again, take the power out of the hands of the employees. Totally take away that power, put it back into IT. IT staff are the biggest, weakest link that we see. They don't change, they turn off all their security settings, basically. They don't change their passwords. They keep the same passwords for their standard user account and their admin account. And they never change those. Those are generally weak. They turn off multi-factor authentication. This leads to a huge amount of weakness. So that is where the real weakness lies in companies. So I'd say focus on those basic things. Really work on those. And if you're not sure what to do, try and align yourself to a framework. Get the NIST framework. Work through those controls. Try and understand what you need to do, where your gaps are, what you're not doing. Try to set up a mature program. Definitely get a penetration test done by a reputable company to make sure you understand where your vulnerabilities do lie and how vulnerable you are, how at risk you are. And think about connecting with a really great consulting partner who can bring in years of experience to really bolster the skills that you're currently employing in-house, because that's going to be key. People have seen it, done it, lots of years of experience, know what's good to focus on, what doesn't, not so important to focus on, and that'll really set you straight. I think that's what I'd like to leave the listeners with.
Well, it's interesting that you say about going back to basics, because I just wrote a blog posting right before a podcast this morning just exactly on that topic. In fact, the title I used was a twist on Neil Armstrong's famous saying. So the title of this one is, "The key to effective cybersecurity is not taking a giant step for mankind, but taking a small step for man." So that, right, I wrote about that, and it's just so true. So anyway, well, Alexander, thank you so much for your time this afternoon, and we look forward to having you on a future podcast.
Yeah, I'd love to do that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care and have a great weekend.
Cheers. Bye-bye.